Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart. And today is a listener question day, one of my favorite things for us to do. With me on the panel, Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds and Adulting. How are you, Miranda?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. It's down below 90 yesterday, getting a little cooler here. Loving it. How is it there in Idaho?
Nice. It's down below 60 here, getting a little cooler. Gonna have snow any day now, I'm sure.
Oh, boy. Okay. And Doug Goldstein in Israel from Goldstein on Geld and Rich as a King. How are you?
Well, doing well. The whole snow thing is a little bit not in the concept of the Middle East, but otherwise, you know, we're pretty good.
And Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins.
Hey!
And the Green Room.
Yeah, I just got back from Maine. Have you ever been to Maine?
I have.
It is amazing.
It's lovely, especially in summer.
I was in camp there when I was 8 years old. It was awesome.
Oh, what's that line from Jerry Maguire? Maine had me at hello. Those of you that live in Maine, I love you.
Beautiful country. Is that, you know, beautiful, you know what I mean? I didn't mean as a country. I meant it's beautiful, you know, but never mind.
Yeah, I hear they're moving over to Canada pretty soon.
Okay, so let's start with our listener question. This listener question comes from Joe. He says, hi there. I've been listening to your podcast, which is great, by the way, for the last few months. I'm 27, and recently my wife and I have invested in a $3,000 to $4,000 over a few ETFs. I think he meant to say they've invested $3,000 to $4,000 over a few ETFs with help from the show. They've been performing well so far, and it's exciting to watch. My question was, based towards companies like AMC that will possibly buy out companies such as Odeon, etc., if they do buy out these companies, does AMC stock go up or does it affect it negatively? Apologies if this comes off a little dumb. It could be common sense, but I'm just curious if there's anything I can learn about companies buying other companies and how it affects stock. Again, love the show. Cheers, Joe. Well, let's start with our Joe. What do you think about buyouts, Joe?
I actually think it's a great question because that's the one that people are always afraid to ask, Linda, as you know. They're always afraid to ask because they think that that's something that they should know. But what's funny is how often when I was a financial planner, I would get questions like this. So the answer is it all depends on what the market sees as the synergies between those two companies. So as an example, as we record this, Tesla and SolarCity, they're about to have their vote on merging those two companies. And so far, it looks like most analysts think that the synergies there don't make sense. But then again, people bet against Elon Musk all the time. And over the years, he's always found a way. So initially, that particular merger looks like it might not have much synergy. The other thing is you also have to look at the underlying business. You know, the movie theater business that Joe talks about, it's pretty cutthroat business. Margins are not that big, even though, you know, I pay an arm and a leg every time I go to a movie theater. So I think there's two steps here. Look at the underlying business and how competitive it is right now. And then you have to think through the synergies of, is this a marriage that looks like it's made in heaven? The bad news about this whole thing, Joe, the pros who have access to every bit as much data as you do, and maybe even a little more, they know how to use that data better than you and I do. And they have computers that help them use that. So any, you know, gotcha or thinking that you're going to get in quickly before the big guy, it's not going to happen. So usually it's already baked into the price by the time you even find out what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Doug, what do you think? And what about if the merger doesn't end up working out? Any advice there?
I want to touch on Joe's baking analogy about baking it into the price. I think one of the things you have to realize, really, there's just two aspects, is that the whole world of buyout rumors is huge. Everyone loves to talk about, oh, this company should have buy out that one. And, you know, rumors begin. And for whatever reason, we don't have to go into who's telling who. But all too often, people hear a rumor and then they begin to believe it's true and they buy the stock. The company they'll tend to buy is the one that's going to be bought out. Which leads me to my next point, which is the company that's going to be bought out, you better hope that the buyout price is going to be considerably higher than what it's trading at now, because otherwise there's no point in doing the deal. So in theory, if you can find the company that actually is going to get bought out, buy it out before the rumors start flying all around, and then it actually does get bought out, you'll make a mint, possibly. But otherwise, be wary. This is yet another example of the possibility of people getting all hyped up in a stock pick instead of buying the way that Linda would probably choose, which is look for ongoing increasing earnings over the years, and that's how you choose a company, rather than based on a buyout rumor.
Mm-hmm. Miranda, anything to add there?
Not really. I think that Joe and Doug pretty much covered it. Just wanted to say good job with the ETFs. Keep it up. And the beautiful thing about investing in ETFs or doing some indexing is that it doesn't matter as much whether or not AMC's stock will go up or down when it buys out a company.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are hedge funds that have this kind of objective to find these kinds of deals. And, you know, it's called arbitrage when you've got a price that is happening in one way and then something comes along and something else happens and you make the difference. But, you know, in this case, it's a movie theater. It's not like a biotech or something that's like something really sexy, I would say. Not that that necessarily makes a difference, but in the past, a technology company, a biotech company, tends to have a different premium or different PE ratios assigned to them. They can move much higher than sort of old traditional companies. So I would say I don't think that there's maybe a big profit in this situation, but I think you also have to look at what if something doesn't go through. There can be deals that don't go through due to antitrust situations. If that happens, then the deal falls apart, then the price goes, you know, theoretically back to where it was before the deal. So just some things to think about. I wouldn't consider this a good investment personally. I would consider this something risky and to stay away from. But, you know, if you have a little bit of cash and you're wanting to learn a lesson, you might learn something on this. I don't know.
It's a great point you make, Linda, because people are attracted to volatility and volatile situations and headlines. And whenever there's a merger, it's headlines, it's a volatile time to invest. And I totally agree with you. For most people, that's the time to stay away, because although we know it's volatile, we don't. There's so many factors that we can't know. And when you talk to seasoned investors, the thing that separates seasoned great investors from amateurs is that they love being in situations where they can know as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times people mistake volatility. They say, oh, well, I'm a long-term investor, so it'll be okay. But that kind of volatility is not necessarily a good thing, because there's right. So many places where this can fall apart, not the least of which is when one company buys another. They've got to go through this whole integration process and, you know, two different workplace cultures and management struggles, because everyone's trying to keep his job, you know, and that can really create a lot of problems in the merger. So watch out for all that. And like Joe said, the guys in the know maybe know, but if you're not, then stay away.
Well, Doug, you know who creates most of those mergers. There's Wall Street departments, and they make tons of money off those mergers. So maybe even looking further, seeing who the company is that creates the merger. I wouldn't do this, by the way. I'm just saying, if you want to bet on anybody, bet on the company that's going to make money. That might be Goldman Sachs, right?
Right, right. But we don't give stock recommendations.
Right.
Yes. All right, let's move on to question number two from Nicholas. Hello, guys and gals. I'm going to insert there, Nicholas. Really like your show. It's informative, and I love how you guys keep an easygoing attitude about making this podcast. It really makes it so much easier to learn. Well, thank you, Nicholas. I am a 25-year-old dude from Sweden that wants to start learning more about investing and everything that's related. I have listened a lot to your show and other podcasts as well, and I want to start learning more about actually researching certain investment options and companies myself, such as ETFs, mutual funds, stocks, etc. When I go on a website like Yahoo Finance or such, I do not really know where to look and what weight to put on different information, such as net income, 52-week highs, what sector the investment option is in, etc. My question is, how do you research investment options? Can you give an example of how you would research a stock and an index. Keep up the great work on the podcast. When will we be able to invest in your Money Tree fund? With a smiley face. Signed, Nicholas. Let's have Miranda start with that. How should he research, Miranda?
Oh, dear. Well, as we know, when I do a little bit of research, I look for an all-market fund, and then I invest in it because it's an all-market fund and it covers everything. But when you get right down to it, a good place to start looking at any sort of company, if you want to do individual stocks, I think a good place to look is the balance sheet. Get an idea, get a feel for how the company functions, what the assets and liabilities are, what the outstanding, you know, obligations are, and you can get a pretty good feel for what kind of state that company is in when you start with the balance sheet. And these things are available. They have to be made publicly available if they're publicly traded stock. So it's something that you can find fairly easily. So I would start with the balance sheet if I was looking at an individual stock. When I research an index, most of the time, I'm just looking for something that's broad-based, that's going to cover a very large swath of the market, because then that reduces my overall risk. Does that make sense? So if I'm researching an index, I just look for something like an all-market fund or something that follows. You know, I use the S&P 500. It has a pretty good swath of the market. Or, you know, I have an all-world fund because I want to include some international investments. So I'd look for things that cover a wide swath of the market and that are very general when I specifically look for an index.
So how do you find that? Do you Google certain words? Do you go to Vanguard? Where do you find those?
Yeah, basically, you just Google S&P 500 ETF.
Okay.
And you have options.
Fair enough.
Or if you already have a brokerage account, like I do with Capital One Investing, I just go in there and, you know, I see what's available. I look for the keywords, or I Google, you know, S&P 500 index fund, see what the little stock ticker symbol is, and then I can just put it into my brokerage account and see if they have it.
Okay. How about Doug?
Well, dude. Miranda covered the ETF side of it, so let me talk a little bit about looking at stock picking. One of the things that I recently discovered when I was working on a course that I'm going to be teaching about just basic financial planning was there are so many different ratios and numbers that people look at for stocks. It literally can drive you crazy. And often they seem to contradict each other, but I think the fundamental numbers that stock investors have looked at for forever have been the earnings of a company, and therefore the price earnings ratio, the dividend that a company pays, which is the income you get on a quarterly basis, and the volume, meaning how much the company actually trades on the stock exchange. Not that it has that makes a difference whether it's 10 million or 15 million, but just to make sure that you're not investing in some company that trades, you know, 4,000 shares a day. So I would start, if you want to learn about it, just literally look up those terms: earnings, price earnings ratio, dividend, and volume. And when you begin to choose stocks, start to compare similar kind of stocks based on these ratios. And that should be a good beginning for the research of setting up a portfolio.
Okay. Joe, how do you set up a stock or ETF research?
You know, it's funny. I'm not going to go into what I do today because of the fact that I've been doing this for so long that we could do a series of 50 podcasts about like how I set these things up. But what I thought that I might do is just take a stock, and this is not a stock recommendation. I just always think that Harley Davidson is a fun stock to look at just because it's ticker symbol HOG, and I always think it's fun. Companies.
And you drive a Hager, right, Joe? You actually have? You're a collector?
My mom does, but not me. But if we take a look at Harley Davidson, just some easy things to look at. There's two different things that I do. I take a very quick first pass. And if you just go to Yahoo Finance, which is a site that I think most of our listeners have access to, you can very easily get some ideas about the company just using one of these quick, easy to access sites. And then that helps you create the list of companies that you might want to look into more. So this is not how I pick an investment, but this is how I get my first look at the investment. So I pull up HOG on Yahoo Finance, and it gives me this summary. And I very quickly look at at the range of the stock, where the stock's been the last 52 weeks. And I have a chart that shows me whether it's near the high or near the low. It's been between 36 and 57. Today it's trading at 55. So it's closer to the high than the low. Now, that by itself doesn't tell me anything, but it begins to build this story and it begins to help me develop a list of questions that I want to ask about the stock. I look at, like Doug said, the PE ratio, but what's more important than the P ratio for me is the P ratio as it compares to other P ratios with companies that do similar things. So when I look at other motorcycle manufacturers, I want to look at what their P ratio is versus Harley Davidson's, because P ratio, the lower that number is, the less risky that stock may be. And once again, doesn't mean I'm not a good investor. I am going to invest, but I want to look at that P ratio in relation to others. I also like the right below it, there's a metric called beta. A beta of one is the average amount of risk in this particular market. So this is a beta of 1.19, which colloquially, it's not exactly this, but that's about 19% more risk than the average stock takes. Once again, I don't want a bunch of letters about how that's not exactly correct, but that's puts you in the ballpark. A beta above one means it's risky. So this stock's going to bounce around a little more. So now already I will know how this company looks to other investors price to earnings ratio wise versus its competitors. I know how volatile it's going to be versus the average thing out there. I know whether it's high or low. And then I click over to financials. And on the financial page, it gives me the last 3 years. And what I see very quickly is in 2013, the company had revenue of a certain number. It went up in 2014, but then it went back down in 2015. Yet when I look at operating expenses, every year operating expenses continue to go up. Doesn't mean I'm going to invest in it or not, but it tells me there was some kind of hiccup and I don't know what that is. And it's another question I want to ask. Then I go and I look at news and I want to know what news has come out recently. And then I look at insiders and I see what insiders have done. Now, people have heard the term insider trading before, but insider trading doesn't mean what a lot of people think it means, which is people going to jail. It just, when an insider trades, they have to show you that they traded. So I want to see what insiders have been doing lately with the stock. That's just my first very quick run through on the company. So I very quickly know Harley Davidson trading near the top of its range. I also know the stock bounces around a little more than the average stock does. I know that they've had some kind of a revenue hiccup. I want to know what that is because costs have continued to go up. And then I know what insiders are doing. And then I have a general feel. And now it becomes a piece of the list that's going to then go down my bigger funnel of, do I invest in this stock? Yes or no.
All right. That was good. A lot of information. And there is a ton of information out there. And all of my colleagues know, and those of our regular listeners know what I'm going to say, which is I use Investor's Business Daily. I actually prefer the newspaper to the website, not because I'm not techie, but just because I like to see it all at a glance. They use the CAN-SLIM acronym that basically puts a lot of stocks through a funnel that brings out the best in relative strength and profitability, leaders in their sectors. And from there, you can look at a lot of those other things that Joe talked about. Most of that work has been done for you, but I do also then go to Yahoo News and look at what are some announcements that have been made recently. Do they have some new invention coming out, some new product coming out? Has an inside employee sold or bought stock? There's a lot of information that you can learn and just get up to date on more about the company, because some of these companies I've never heard of before, and it's good to know what do they actually do. And I like to read over on Yahoo News what they do. So I use the two of those things combined. All right, let's move on to number three. This is from Scott. Dear Money Tree Podcast, I have a question about buying high versus waiting for a fund price to drop. I have a large amount of cash that I would like to invest in some conservative dividend-paying mutual funds. The problem is the strong economy of late has increased the purchase price by about 6%. Is it a bad idea to wait for a short-term drop in the purchase price, or should I disregard short-term fluctuations and just buy as soon as possible? I feel like I've missed out on some low prices, but don't keep my money sitting idle forever. Thanks, Scott. Let's start with Doug. What do you think, Doug?
You know, it's a classic question of can you time the market? And I'm guessing that all of us are going to agree you can't time the market on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm very sympathetic to what Scott's saying, which is, gosh, I really want to, not be a sucker and get in after the market's already, gone up so much. And it's so easy to look back at how the market ran up before the crash in 2008 and how it ran up before the crash in the internet boom before 2000, 2001. And then you feel like, gee, if I had bought then, I would have lost everything. That's on the one hand, or not everything. And of course, and I think the answer that you really have to realize is no one has the ability to time the market. And over time, when the market does go up, it's got to go up. In other words, if you believe that in the long term, the market's going up, you're always going to be buying it probably at a price that it was higher than yesterday or last year. So you've got to get in at some point. So I would go back to our previous question and just say, does the investment seem to have good fundamentals currently? And if the answer to that is yes, and you see this as a long-term investment, then go ahead and bite the bullet and invest. And understand, you might be timing it wrong, and you might be literally buying the day before the market crashes. But if you feel that it's a fundamentally good investment, I don't think you should try to time it.
Miranda, what do you think about market timing?
I think market timing doesn't really work. I think that you can get a general feel for overall trends, like what Linda talks about sometimes, like you can get a feel for the way the wind is blowing, but you're never going to get that exact right time down. And so you just need to make your plans based on which way the wind is blowing, or do what I do, just kind of have this long-term indexing outlook.
Okay. Joe, should he wait or should he buy in?
Well, I don't have a lot to add except for what the statistics are. And historically, the market goes up about 70% of the time. So realize that you're trying to play Monday morning quarterback, where later on you're going to say, I should have, right? Mm-hmm. And take that off the table, because you never know. It's generally over time a losing game to wait. But if you're really feeling worried, I think a prudent move might be to dollar cost average instead, where you take, if you've got a big sum of money you're putting into the market at once and you're very worried about the market conditions, split it up into pieces and maybe do it over a 6-month period or even a year period. But the longer you wait to put money in the market, historically, 70% of the time, you won by putting it in right now. So that's what you're betting against.
Can I just comment on the opposite side of this question? Just because, sure. I think a lot of times people make a mistake, which is that they are invested and they're in the market, and then they don't realize that they need the money soon. In fact, I recently sat with a client who came in and said that he had put aside money for his daughter's wedding. And this, he'd done this like when she was little. I said, okay, great. And then he said to me recently, okay, it looks like she's getting engaged now and the wedding's going to be pretty soon. Do you think I should sell? I said, what do you mean, do I think? Of course you should sell. What do you think is going to happen between now and in 6 months when she gets married? Do you think the market's going to shoot up and you're going to make so much more money? Because if it goes, because I don't think that's going to happen, A. And B, if it goes down, the damage that you're causing, it could be dramatic to, instead of having a wedding at the Hilton, you'll have it at the Y, and that'll disappoint your daughter. But the time frame on this investment has now changed from being a long-term investment to being a short-term investment, and short-term money should not be in the stock market.
Good point.
I wish I was the smartest, Doug.
I would just like to put in my 2 cents for dollar cost averaging as well. I think there's no reason why you have to put in everything right now, Scott, and you could, put in some and put in some a little later. And like Joe said, dollar cost average over, many months perhaps. But I think that, overall timing doesn't work. The studies have shown that it doesn't work and that long-term investing is where it's at. And if you're investing for 10 or 20 years and that's how long you're staying in this fund, you probably won't care by then whether it was up or down 6% when you bought it. So the important thing is to get in and get invested.
You know what, Linda? What I really like about your approach whenever you talk is that it's similar to approach I read many years ago in this older book called Trading Rules. I think it's out of print, but it was a guy that traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which, for those people that know that exchange, it's a really risky thing that this guy does. And he had his trading rules, and they were all based on defense and stuff that the average investor doesn't think of. And it surprised me how this guy who does something super risky, all he worries about is not losing money, even though he's in a risky marketplace. If you like the investment, you're not playing the game of what's it going to do tomorrow. You like it now or you don't like it now, and that's it. So playing the game of, do I think it's going to go up or down later, is a losing bet.
Yeah.
Are we all just agreeing and saying, I want to clarify, because I think we should leave him with a clear answer. We're all saying you should get in. If you believe that the investment is a good investment where it's priced now, get in. And the compromise that we're saying is, if you don't really have enough confidence, then go ahead and dollar cost average. But that's not the first choice. Is that what the Money Tree panel is suggesting?
We're saying if it's good, invest in it, but don't try and time the market.
I'm saying yes, Doug. Anything that says yes.
Right? Sure.
I'll agree. I just want to make sure we're on the same side of the page here.
That's totally my point.
Okay. Let's go on to David. What is a good book for beginners to read to learn about value investing? I want to learn how to evaluate a company properly, but I'm struggling to find an appropriate read for beginners. Miranda, what do you think?
Yeah. So Benjamin Graham pretty much wrote the book on value investing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would start there. And it's been updated since then to include, it's called The Intelligent Investor. And it's been updated since he wrote it. And it's been updated by Jason Zweig, or however we want to say the guy's name, from Zweig. The Wall Street Zweig, Journal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think if you want to learn about value investing, I think The Intelligent Investor is a great place to start. And I mean, it's the classic. It is the textbook. It is the place to go.
I would agree with that. And it talks about the margin of safety and gives you a good explanation of what that is. And of course, that was Warren Buffett's mentor. So great resource. Doug, what do you recommend for value investing?
Well, I have to make a disclaimer. I have a conflict of interest because my deal with my publisher is I'm only allowed to promote my own books. So go ahead and buy Rich as a King, which is all about how to, you know, the wisdom of chess makes you a grandmaster of investing. But I'm sure there are other good books out there, too.
All right. Joe, what do you suggest for value investing?
You know, I will second what Miranda said, but I'll add, I also like learning about growth at a reasonable cost. So Peter Lynch, Beating the Street, I think is a good book. A book that's often misquoted, like we've talked about here before.
Yes.
People say that Peter Lynch said, buy what you know, not what he says. That's the beginning. Make a list of stuff that you know. Do kind of what we talked about earlier in the show, where you use that list of what you know to create a closer to the belt list and then put it through a rigorous buy process. But I really, that's what I learned from Peter Lynch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Morgan is our next letter writer. First off, I want to start by saying thank you all for this free educational resource. I have listened to every episode from Linda, Joe, and Miranda. Doug is next. After listening to the roundtable debate on the 2008 housing bubble, I was wondering, how much of an impact does the Federal Reserve have on these crashes with the controlling of interest rates? And would we do better if interest rates were free market instead of regulated?
Oh, boy.
Would it help eliminate some bubbles? Would love to hear your thoughts, as I have learned an incredible amount listening to the roundtable. Thanks and keep it up. You are inspiring many young adults to take control of their financial future.
And this is where it stops right here. This is where we stop inspiring people and start pissing them off.
All right. Well, if Joe doesn't want to start, maybe Doug wants to start, sounds like.
No, I'm happy to hear Joe first, but I think this
Go is... for it. Go for it, Doug.
This is perhaps the world's greatest idea. I think that there's so much control. By the way, there are tons of books about this, starting with Ben Bernanke's book and all the guys who were around during the 2008 complete destruction of the economy, where they were literally pulling all-nighters to make multi-trillion dollar decisions that affected everyone on the planet. And I think that's a little bit scary. I think it is frightening that there is so much power in the hands of just a few people. And I'm not saying that, I mean, they're brilliant. And I think Ben Bernanke is a brilliant guy, but there is a limit. Whereas if interest rates, like everything else that we buy and sell, the cost of cash is just a commodity. It's something you buy and sell. And the price of that commodity should be determined by the free market, because then it'll be fair. It'll be exactly what it's worth, instead of when, you know, the government is trying to control things and to control so much about our spending and how much we pay for houses and how much we pay to borrow money. it's a huge mistake.
So the government's the only thing that influences the market. Is that what you're saying here? There's not big players or big institutional investors, and the market is efficient. Is that what you're trying to say here? And
the market is much more efficient
to do with it. I'm just trying to understand here.
No, market is much more efficient than a few people in Washington making these decisions.
Yeah, but I mean, clearly. So if we have a bunch of institutional investors making all these decisions, then that's cool.
I'm not letting them make the decisions. They can trade just like you and I can trade. And if it's not worth the price to borrow money at 5%, which maybe it's what it's worth today, you won't. And then rates will go back down.
I don't know. Right.
Listen, we're getting into this again right now. We all see it happening. The rates are so low, people are borrowing money again.
Oh, well, no. Well, yeah, that I'm not disagreeing with. I totally see that one of the main problems with our economy, that it's entirely based on consumer spending based on debt, and we rely too much on consumer spending based on debt to, like, fuel the
economy. Which
the
government feeds us so that we vote for them back into power.
Yeah. The thing I take main issue with is this idea that once government control or government influence goes away, suddenly there will be no influence from other large entities that will step in and try and fill the vacuum, like corporations or large institutional investors. You know, I mean, once you say, oh, well, just make the market completely free, I have my air quotes going here, because I don't believe that there's any such thing. I honestly believe that there will always be people who take advantage of that and who are going to have some sort of institutional power or their own personal power or influence in the markets that are going to step in and fill that vacuum and essentially provide the same sort of situation. It may not be interest rate control, but it'll be some other type of control that puts us at even more of a disadvantage if we're not as wealthy and powerful.
Joe, would you like to comment on that?
Probably no.
Well, Doug needs to respond.
Oh, I know what to say, but give someone else a turn.
I totally interrupted him to, like, scream and yell in my tirade.
I think the Federal Reserve plays an important role in the economy. I often disagree with the tack that they take. I think that they spend too much time making sure that people can continue to take out debt that they can't afford, because with a very short-term view, that keeps the economy humming along right now. And if you look at the way people keep their jobs, they just want to keep it going the way it is as long as they can, so that by the time that the bag is empty, they can hand it to somebody else who gets blamed for it. I don't like that approach, but I do think there's an important role there, and I find it frustrating. But, you know, just historically, the way I stay out of this argument is that I just think to myself that my job is to deal with the facts the way they are now. I generally can't change those facts. I can only deal with what is in front of me and make sure that when I was a financial advisor and now with my own personal money, that I'm most efficient with the game the way it is laid out today. I can spend time fighting the game and trying to make the game the way I think it should be, but man, that's a much tougher game than paying attention to my stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like to say that the Federal Reserve is not a federal agency.
Good
it's
point,
a group
Linda.
Of personal private bankers that have a lot of power that were not elected. If you want to hear how the Federal Reserve actually came together under some very interesting conditions, there's a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Oh, gosh.
That is a very good story of the truth behind the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve.
All top secret meetings. Right,
yes.
Exactly. It's exactly what the conspiracy theories that people believe is what's going on.
But the Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express is. So there is nothing federal. It is not a government agency. And it is private bankers who control that. So,
and I think that's a good point to remember as well, that, I mean, it was set up specifically so that there wouldn't be the same kind of political backlash. Of course, it's, once again, it goes back to that whole private idea of, you know, private people running the show.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, this is not a bunch of private people like the four of us getting together and deciding to, you know, set the nation's monetary policy, which is what the Fed does, right? In other words, they do have power over all of us, and it's incredible power. They are potentially as powerful as the legislative branch of the government, and we are all suffering and have suffered as a result of many decisions that they've made. And it's going to happen again. You know, why we all say, oh, isn't it nice to be able to borrow money for cheap? But it doesn't make sense. We're in a world that doesn't make sense. And wouldn't it be nice for those of us who are capitalists, to understand that the reason that things go up in price is because people value them more. And the reason they go down in price is because people value them less. And then we'll understand what the price of money is all about, which is what the Fed sets.
All right. From the fire.
I just want to agree with Joe on one thing, which is, what are we going to do? Nothing we can do about this here.
Yeah, so. Well, we're gonna jump from the frying pan into the fire, because now we're going to talk about religion.
Yes.
So Athena says, I really enjoyed the episode, The Morality of SRI and Google Cars, but as an atheist, ooh, I was disheartened to hear that the talk surrounding morality focused on religion being the primary standard for moral decisions. Ooh. While I did enjoy listening to the rabbi's input, I would love to hear other sources addressing SRI that do not use religious standards. In regards to autonomous cars, I am 100% ready to own one as long as the priority is my family. As the mother of a five-year-old, I would not place her in an autonomous car without knowing that in the passenger versus pedestrian scenario, she, my daughter, would be the car's priority. So even if only one person is riding, the car needs to protect its passengers above all, in my opinion. I really like the discussions and the different views you all provide. Keep up the good work.
Hi, Athena. So I'm with you. I feel you. As an agnostic humanist, I totally understand that. And one of the things that I find in terms of my own personal morality, I like to look instead at the type of good that can be done in the world. And I think you have to look inside yourself to figure out, you know, how that matters to you. And in terms of your own priorities, your daughter is your highest priority. And so I think that works for your own morality and trying to figure that out. As far as investing SRIs, my personal values, if I were to do that and measure that, I would look at it in terms of how does it impact the environment. I would look at environmental factors, because we all live here on this planet as humanity, and we don't want to screw it up more than we already have. I look for things in terms of what sort of practices are we looking at here, wage practices, environmental practices, human rights practices. So those are the kinds of things I would look at if I was going to look into socially responsible investing. As far as my own personal things go, I actually like to look at things in terms of like local, doing things locally, starting with my community, and then hoping for the kind of that ripple effect. My first goal is, hey, let's try to do as little harm as possible and then move forward to move on and do as much good as I can. I don't know if that helps, but there you are.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your perspective and for sharing that. Does anyone else want to make a comment? Okay.
Well, as the guy who brought the rabbi to the show, I sort of feel a little bit responsible to answer it. But first of all, Athena, I want to thank you very much, A, for your interesting letter, and B, for noting that you, in fact, do agree with what the rabbi said. Your opinion is the same as his. And I think that wherever you're going to get your morality from, the main question is, and I think what the rabbi was pointing out, was that certainly as a religious leader, he believes that morality is something that's absolute and is not relative. And one of the funny things about believing in a kind of a relative morality is then each of the people, you know, who you're talking to, including the people on this panel, we might just decide what at the moment feels good to us and, you know, recommend that. Whereas having one central core belief that we can all turn to, in this case, God, it certainly makes it easier, if not more correct, in order to make a decision. I'm not sure that was your question, but since you brought it up, I just wanted to suggest, understand the difference between a relative morality, which means everyone just does, you know, whatever they feel like, and an absolute morality, which is everyone submitting to one opinion.
Well, I think part of the issue that you run into with that, though, especially with the religious idea, is, you know, whose absolute morality are we going with? Are you going to go with your interpretation of God or so-and-so's interpretation of what God wants? Because back when I definitely believed in God, my interpretation of morality, what was right and was wrong, was completely different from, say, somebody who literally took the Old Testament as, like, the literal truth. So even that is subject to some degree of relative morality. But I think Athena makes a good point that you don't have to have religion to be a moral or good person or have that moral compass.
Now, what I do like, though, with the rabbi being on the show was that as an introductory point of view for a bigger discussion that people listening have with people that they know or, you know, just having here with the show. So I know that a guy with a Catholic education that one of my favorite classes was a class that explored different philosophical points of view, not just different religions, but different philosophies. So it's funny when whenever someone tells me that they're an atheist, I think a lot of religious people think that the atheist is like one set thing, but two atheists will have the biggest argument ever about morality.
No, I love religion. I love studying religion. I love studying philosophy, and religion is very interesting to me. And I have no problem with the rabbi being on. I think it was great that he was on to provide that context and provide that starting point. You know, and I have no problem with religion and having religion in life. I think it's enriching for many people and that it helps a lot of people and people, you know, it enriches their lives, and there's nothing wrong with it. But at the same time, I do agree with Athena that, you know, trying to say, oh, well, if you don't have religion or if you don't believe in God, then you're a terrible person or there are no moral standards. You know, that's not true either. I think, you know, we people are people. There are plenty of good people who don't believe in God, and there are plenty of terrible people who do. So it's just the way it is.
Good point. On that note, why don't we say what is going on in our respective areas? Doug, what's going on at Goldstein on Gelt?
Well, Goldstein on Gelt, and in fact, Rich is a King, which I had mentioned earlier, our podcasts continue to grow. We've actually had, we've spoken a lot recently about how to select individual investments. And those have been pretty popular episodes, which are at richasaking.com and goldsteinongelt.com.
Great. And Joe, what's going on at Stacking Benjamins in the Green Room?
We have our big 400th episode coming up.
Oh, congratulations. Well,
thank you very much. A lot of people can't believe that we actually made it that far. We can't believe we made it that far. And what's funny is we can't count because we've actually done probably around 440 episodes, but for a while we weren't numbering the Friday ones. So it's officially number 400, but we have no idea what number it is, which is the way we do things at Stacking Benjamins. So that's coming up on the show. We're gonna go through some of our favorite interviews with people that were not from the financial community, like Austin Kleon, who's an artist who talks about business, from a woman who studied nuns and why they live longer than the population in general, and then to the guy that broke the Cannonball Run record, which is the fastest illegal drive from New York City to Los Angeles. Talk about planning. It was a good lesson on planning. And then from the producer of many of the hit Disney movies that people like. So some of our favorite interviews we're going to play during that show.
Fantastic. Miranda, what's going on at Planting Money Seeds and Adulting?
I'm just going to kind of plug adulting.tv real quick because coming up is my review of OkCupid. It has nothing to do with money other than whether or not paying to be on the A-list is worth it. But yeah, head on over to adulting.tv, read my experience with OkCupid, and let me know if you want me to sign up for another dating site and try that out too.
I think we want to hear all your escapades with those dating sites. It's pretty interesting. And sometimes funny. So
maybe we could bring the rabbi back and they could be part of the discussion.
Matchmaker, match.
That sounds like good radio right there.
Oh, boy. Well, over on Be Wealthy and Smart, we're talking about where can you invest and find high rates, because people continually ask for where are rates high, where can you get those old 8% rates that we used to have years ago that don't really exist today. And we're going to talk about reaching for rate, sometimes being risky, and what you might want to think about instead. So thank you for listening today. Thank you for your letters. We really appreciate that. Miranda, how about taking us home here?
Make sure you check us out at moneytreepodcast.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Leave us a review and ask us your questions. We love the mail. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.